Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9.5 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Thursday, May the 15th. We are pleased to have with us this hour a woman named by Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in 2008 for her work in helping all of us understand our brains and how they work and their capacity for recovery following an injury like a stroke. Jill Bolte Taylor is a brain scientist and a stroke survivor. She suffered a stroke in 1996 and recovered from it. And she writes about her journey in the book, My Stroke of Insight, originally published in 2006 and newly released this month. If you or any of you know of anyone who has suffered from a stroke or another brain injury, if you work with brain-injured patients in any capacity, or if you're completely healthy and haven't given a lot of previous thought to what happens when someone suffers a stroke, you will learn something from this story, and I hope you will join in with your questions or experiences. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jill Bolte Taylor is a neuroanatomist with the Indiana School of Medicine. She is the national spokesperson for the mentally ill at the Harvard Brain Tissue Resource Center, the Brain Bank. She consults with the Midwest Proton Radiotherapy Institute, and she is the author of My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey. And she was recently named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World for 2008. She lives in Bloomington, Indiana, where she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Congratulations on your Time Magazine designation.
Thank you.
And thank you for your book and for your work in helping us understand how the brain works. You have been interested, fascinated with the brain forever because you have a brother who is mentally ill.
Yes, I have a brother who, he's only 18 months older than I am, and he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And so he was my really constant companion as a child, and it was obvious to me at an early age that he was very different in the way he perceived the world and then chose to behave. So I really became fascinated in how two people can have the exact same experience but walk away with completely different interpretations of what had just happened.
Yeah. So you were spending a lot of time researching the brain and working for the Brain Bank when this happened to you.
Exactly. I was in Boston, and I was actually traveling around as the singing scientist because there's a shortage of brain tissue donated for the kind of research that I was doing, which is the post-mortem investigation of the brain as it relates to schizophrenia. And I woke up one morning in 1996 and to discover that I had a brain disorder of my own.
Yeah, you had a headache, a pain behind your left eye.
I had a pounding, pulsating pain behind the left eye. And I, of course, had no idea. And it was the first thing in the morning when I woke up. And apparently four times more strokes occur, or more strokes occur in the morning when people first awake because of the increase in pressure, blood pressure, when they sit up after being reclined throughout the night.
Yeah. When did you realize that you were in trouble, that this wasn't just a headache?
Well, I noticed immediately that my perception had shifted. I was on a cardioglider, which is a full-body, full-exercise machine. And I realized that my perception had shifted away from being the person on the machine having the experience to some esoteric space where I was witnessing myself having this experience. So I noticed immediately that things were peculiar, but I had no idea that I was actually having a stroke until my right arm went totally paralyzed.
Then that was the aha moment.
That was the aha moment for me.
Yeah. Yet you knew you needed to get help, yet you couldn't think to call 911.
Exactly. Where the type of stroke that I had was a hemorrhage. And the hemorrhage, the broken vessels, began right near where my brain organizes language in the left hemisphere. And part of language right behind that is numbers. And so numbers and 911 and anything that went remotely close to that was no longer there. So I didn't have 911 as an option.
Yeah, yet you struggled to remember your number at work.
I did. I had a plan. Mm-hmm. The only plan that I had was to call work, but I did not remember the number at work, even though it was as simple as 1-800-BRAIN-BANK. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't remember it, so I had to go and find a business card in order to be able to identify what that number was.
But you couldn't really read the text on the business card either.
Exactly. When I looked at the card, all I could see were pixels, the letters and the background all blended together, and all I could see were the pixels. But then I would have these waves of clarity, if you will, and they would reattach me to the normal reality, and then I'd be able to see, okay, that's not the card. But eventually I did find the card, but I didn't understand numbers at that point, so I had to match the squiggle on the card to the squiggle on the telephone. And so it was quite a drama that morning.
Yeah. Eventually you did call the work number, and you could hear your voice speaking perfectly in your mind, but the words weren't coming out clearly.
Exactly. I did not know that I could not speak language or understand language until I tried, even though I could hear myself inside of my mind saying, "This is Jill, I need help." What came out of my voice was, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa." Mm-hmm. So it was, I was very fortunate that my colleague recognized me.
Yeah. We will get more of the story after we check our weather forecast. We are talking with a brain scientist who writes about her own experience suffering from and recovering from a stroke. The book is My Stroke of Insight, and Jill Bolte Taylor will answer your questions and maybe even respond to your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 18 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Thursday, May the 15th. Coming up later this morning after 10 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn talks with a doctor about a new trend in caring for the elderly called slow medicine. And we hope you will join in for that after 10 o'clock this morning. We're talking medicine to a certain extent during this hour as we talk with Jill Bolte Taylor, who is the author of the book My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey. It tells her story of suffering from a massive stroke back in 1996, a stroke that could have killed her, but she understood what was happening to her. She got help. Not only did she recover, she regained her lost abilities, and she gained a tremendous amount of insight. And we are talking about that during this hour, and we are welcoming your questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Jill was recently featured in a recent Time magazine piece on the 100 most influential people in the world in 2008. So you finally did reach a colleague at work at the Brain Bank on that morning in 1996, and that colleague couldn't really understand what you were saying, but understood it was you and that you needed help.
Right. So he actually came to my home because they didn't know what kind of problem that I was having.
Yeah.
And then he took me to the hospital. And we did have a CAT scan taken of the brain, and it showed a major hemorrhage in the left half of my brain.
Yeah. So tell us what you're feeling at this point. What's going through your mind?
Actually, not much was going through my mind. It was a fascinating experience because in the left hemisphere of the brain is where our ability to create language exists. And it's that ongoing brain chatter that is always relating our internal world to our external world and our external world to our internal world. It's kind of like, did you ever stop and think about how it is that you know what your name is? Mm-hmm. You know what your name is because there are these cells inside of your head that are reminding you all the time what your name is and where you live, et cetera. And when the hemorrhage happened in the left hemisphere, it wiped out the language center. And when it wiped out the language center, it shifted me away from having any relationship with the external world, and I became captivated with the present moment. And in the present moment, there was no language. It was total silence, and I experienced this feeling of bliss and euphoria. And it was beautiful there. So not a lot was going on in my mind, and other people would look at me and think, oh, my gosh, Jill is a mess, but I still felt that I was perfect and whole and beautiful just the way that I was. I just was no longer capable of communicating with the external world in any kind of normal way.
So you weren't frightened?
No, I was very fortunate that early on, because I'm a neuroanatomist and I study the brain, watching my brain go through the process of deterioration was an insight for me. I desperately, my whole life, wanted to understand what was the difference between my normal mind and the mind of my brother diagnosed with schizophrenia. And here I was getting a firsthand experience of watching my brain completely deteriorate in its ability to process information. So I was very curious. I was fortunate that the curious scientist came out. And once I became so ill that I couldn't walk, talk, read, write, or recall any of my life, by that point, I was too far gone to experience fear because there was nothing to fear at that stage because I was just experiencing euphoria.
Well, you did at one point have the thought cross your mind anyway that you wanted to remember all of this so you could chronicle it later.
I did. Yeah. As my brain was going through deterioration, there was a moment where I caught sight of myself in the mirror, and I just asked myself, please, please remember, please remember. The right hemisphere thinks in pictures, and the left hemisphere thinks in language. So my right hemisphere was fine, and it was going to be fine. And there was this videotaping, essentially, that my brain was remembering about the morning of the stroke. And I figured if I survived and I could go back and put language back on that videotape, then I would be able to communicate the morning of the stroke and moment by moment what it felt like to experience a stroke. And I thought that that was extremely important because then if anybody read that morning of the stroke and they had any of those symptoms, then they themselves would recognize maybe this is a stroke and I need to get myself help sooner rather than later.
Yeah. So your mother came to your side immediately?
My mother lived in Terre Haute, Indiana, mm-hmm. and I was in Boston when this mm-hmm. happened. And so my boss called her and told her what was going on and told her that they had stabilized my body, but that she would need to come for long-term care because I would need that. So my mother came out from Terre Haute, and she just recognized immediately that I was no longer her Harvard doctor daughter, as she had called me, and I was now her infant again.
Mm, yeah.
So she just swooped me up in her arms, and we began from the beginning where I was her baby again.
I
was very blessed.
Did you know who she was?
I did not. I did not even know what a mother was, much less who my mother was. I had lost all information. I describe myself as an infant in a woman's body. I just had zero information about the external world.
So I don't mean to fast forward, but when did it start coming back?
In the beginning, I couldn't get any of my moments to fit together. You know, when you think about how you usually think, you have this moment and then you have the last moment, and that makes the next moment predictable. And I didn't have the ability to have any moment other than the current moment. And so it was really difficult for me to learn anything because all I had was the present moment, and as soon as I would turn my back on this present moment, then I would have a new present moment that was not connected to the last one. So you can imagine how difficult that would be to be able to learn.
Yeah.
And periodically, throughout the process, I was a very fast learner because I still had a visual understanding of things. I just didn't have any words for them anymore. I didn't have any labels. And when I looked into the world, I saw one big field of view. I couldn't discriminate any boundaries between anything. So I couldn't pick a couch out from a plant right next to it. So I had to relearn how to perceive the world the way that the left hemisphere does. And it was weeks before the left hemisphere, 2.5 weeks after the hemorrhage, I had to have major brain surgery. And so the physicians went in and they removed a blood clot the size of a golf ball that was pushing on those fibers. And once they removed that, for the next couple of weeks, I still didn't have any brain chatter. But then I started to be able to learn again. Most all my memories were totally wiped out. My language skills were reduced to maybe a tenth. Maybe I understood a tenth, if that, of language. So I had to relearn vocabulary and figure out how to redefine things.
I'm thinking about how difficult that must be to learn things in that situation. It is truly amazing that you were able to recover as you were. Are you unique? I mean, do people generally recover from a stroke such as yours?
It depends on, again, the kind of stroke. I was in many ways fortunate that the stroke happened in the outer portion of my brain, the cerebral cortex, because that's where my knowledge was. And if, you know, losing my mind is one thing, and it's funny because people say, oh my gosh, that would be terrible to lose my mind. And actually, it's not that bad because you don't know what you've lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not, you know, looking at yourself with that kind of pity. Because the brain's not saying, hey, you don't know this, you don't know that. It just doesn't know it. So it would have been more life-threatening, not I almost died that day because I did, but it was much more life-threatening, and I probably would have died if the hemorrhage had happened at the region of my brainstem.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, everything else inside of the nervous system was fine. I just lost cognitive knowledge and cognitive ability. But over time, and I really credit my mother with her caregiving, I do believe that I was very fortunate, one, because first I believed in the ability of the brain to recover itself. And that meant that we had to get out of its way and give it what it needed in order for those cells to become healthy again. And one of the things that we did that traditional rehabilitation does not do is we allowed my brain to sleep as much as it wanted to sleep. And then when I was awake, Mom took me to the bathroom, she fed me, and then she put me to work immediately on age-appropriate toys. Yeah.
We will talk more about the rehab process and other insights that our guest gained as a someone who suffered from a stroke and survived it, recovered from it. She's a brain scientist, Jill Bolte Taylor, and her book is My Stroke of Insight. We will check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will return. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 6:36 on this Thursday, May the 15th. We are talking with Jill Bolte Taylor, who was featured in Time magazine recently as one of the 100 most influential people in the world in 2008. She teaches at the Indiana University School of Medicine. She researches the brain. She is the national spokesperson for the mentally ill at the Harvard Brain Tissue Resource Center. She also consults with the Midwest Proton Radiotherapy Institute, and she is the author of the book, My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey, which chronicles her own stroke, a brain hemorrhage, back in 1996 that she recovered from. And she's here to tell us her story and to answer your questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, I've been hogging the microphone, the conversation, all this time, so let me go to the phones and take our first caller, Nick in Prairie Farm. Hi, Nick, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy. My question is, now this brain bleed that you had, did that cause hypofluid fusion in your brain, and that's what caused the injury, or was it the development of the clot and then the resulting pressure that did so much damage?
I did not have a blood clot. It was not an ischemic stroke. It was hemorrhagic. And it was caused by a congenital malformation in the blood vessels. I had an arteriovenous malformation where an artery was directly connected to a vein without a capillary network in between. So this was a malformation in the blood vessels that I was born with, and it was essentially a bomb waiting to blow in my brain. And they usually blow between the ages of 25 and 45, and I was 37 at the time.
Wow. Now, my mother suffered a stroke, but it was the ischemic kind. She had a blocked carotid artery, and so that stopped the blood from getting to her brain. She was paralyzed on her right side. So that's the same as so that means that she suffered the injury on the left side of the brain?
Right.
Yeah. And she lost her ability to speak. She remained paralyzed on her right side, so she couldn't walk. She was in a wheelchair. She lived on for about 10 years after the stroke itself, and It was very difficult. I didn't, you didn't know how much she could comprehend or not, though I saw that she had a certain blissfulness to her. And I wonder if you might be, I mean, was she maybe feeling what you were describing, that bliss of, I guess, being just in the present?
Well, it was, I'm certainly not the only person who's had a left hemisphere wipeout and had then experienced this experience of bliss and euphoria. And oftentimes people will contact me and say, I don't know what's going on, but they look so happy. There's just this mm-hmm. joyfulness. And my mother would say to me, in the beginning, for the first few weeks, even though I was in this extremely debilitated condition, I would sit on my bed or I'd sit on the couch with this smile on my face. There was just pure peace on my face, and it was because I was detached from any of the normal stress that the rest of the people in the external world were attached to. So it's very easy for us to project our fears and our worst imaginations onto what this person is experiencing simply because they cannot communicate, and oh gosh, how awful that would be. But for me, it was not that negative of an experience, and I think that it's important that people realize that it's our nature to project our own fears onto what someone else is experiencing. And I had gained something. Whenever I look at someone now who has any kind of neurological or different in any way, I ask myself, what has this person gained in the absence of what they have now lost? Because I gained deep internal peace. I experienced the ability to just feel blissful and gratitude in my heart for all that was, and that was a real gift to my life.
Oh, it's very comforting to hear that, too.
I
also, though, wanted to ask you about what you, the insight you gained on the medical community and with your situation in terms of how you were treated and your rehab and such.
Well, it's, it's very different being on the receiving end of any kind of medical procedure. And what I really gained was I was so disabled that I was really down to the energy level. People either brought me energy or they took energy away from me. And I really needed the professionals to come in and treat me with utmost respect. And a lot of times, if you have somebody who's essentially just a warm body lying there in a bed, then you come in and you chat around them and you kind of ignore them and you just you know, mm-hmm. go through the motions of giving them care, but you don't bother to try to connect with that person. And that person may really be observing at that level. But for me, it was an energetic level, and people either brought me energy or they took energy away from me. And I really, in order for me to feel safe in the care of a nurse or a caregiver, I needed that person to try to connect with me and to pay very close attention to who are they being in my presence. So I really advocated for the medical community to kind of wake up to what's going on with people who have brain trauma and to treat them with more respect and dignity and to pay closer attention to how do we communicate with this person even though they don't have language because they are picking up information.
Mm-hmm. Next we go to Cindy in Duluth. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question, which I'm hoping is relevant. When you were describing how the left side of the brain is the language part of the brain, and the right side sees the world more in pictures or is like taking a videotape of the world, I was curious. I've heard things like that about autism, and that autistic people will see the world more in pictures. Did you have any insight into that, or?
Thank you, Cindy. Mm-hmm. Actually, yes. I essentially became autistic when I lost my left hemisphere and viewed the world through the right hemisphere energy dynamic. And one of the, as a brain scientist, I'm no longer doing the same kind of work I was doing before the hemorrhage, but my focus now for interest is how to help autistic children in particular, because their brain is so malleable. What did I do in order to get out of my right hemisphere back into the circuitry of my left hemisphere? And so I really appreciate this question because I do think that we will be able to devise tools and that there are tools available that really help people get from that right hemisphere awareness and thinking in pictures into more verbal skills, and whether that be through the use of music or the use of kinesthetic movement of their body. So I'm very excited about the possibilities of what the future will hold as far as being able to help people who are more right-hemisphered in their visual world develop more of the language center.
Interesting. Well, thank you.
Yeah, Barry.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cindy, for the call. We're going to check our weather forecast and then take more calls for and talk more with Jill Bolte Taylor, who is author of My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey, a book about being a stroke survivor and what she learned. She was recently named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time Magazine for 2008. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your questions for her, maybe even your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. We'll be talking with a political analyst about the state budget repair deal that is now on its way to the governor's desk. That's coming up after 7 o'clock. After 8, by the way, we'll talk with David Horowitz, who is the author of the new book, Party of Defeat. That's after 8. Right now we're talking with the author of My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey, Jill Bolte Taylor, is our guest. She had a stroke, a brain hemorrhage in 1996, and recovered from it. Not only did she regain all of her lost abilities, she gained a lot of insight about how the brain works, how the brain recovers, how we help brain-injured people recover, and we welcome your questions for her. Carl in Peshtigo is with us now. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Yes. I never thought I'd hear another fine guest on your program to enlighten and to incite people such a person to bring her knowledge of experience of her profession. My question would be, how many of your other colleagues can relate as well as you can, and can you have a substantial, more, better impact to help people recover in regards to your mother that helped you as well as she did?
Thank you, Carl. It's been really a beautiful experience for me to share what has happened, because my colleagues have been very, very open to recognizing that there is good care and there is care that is not so good, and that we really are, it's a mystery to look at someone who has had brain trauma and try to have any idea or understanding about what's going on inside of that person, because we're not getting any clues. And so for me, it's been a very satisfying experience to have medical colleagues come to me and say thank you for the insights. In my book, I list 50 recommendations for recovery, and I talk about why I recommend make each of these recommendations. And it just makes sense to people who understand the brain and how the brain is really a conglomeration of cells. What do the cells need in order for them to recover? Because at this point, it's really not about healing the person. It's about healing the cells and creating a cellular environment where the cells can thrive again. And once the cells in the brain begin to thrive again, then we can start working with that person from the external world. So I think that there is a real insight here for the medical community, and it's been heartwarming to me to be so positively received.
Yeah, I wonder if you think we spend enough time on rehabilitation. I don't remember exactly, but it seemed to me that my mother went through some speech therapy, some occupational therapy, you know, physical therapy, for maybe 6 to 8 weeks, and it was determined that she would not recover anymore, and that was that.
Right. Well, you know, and that's part of the problem, because we're placing an artificial boundary on what we want the nervous system to accomplish in X amount of time, and that's just not on the schedule of the nervous system. It takes a long time for neurons to reconnect with one another. Psychosis is a very good example of this. If you have someone who's psychotic and you're going to give them an antipsychotic med, it's going to be 6 to 8 weeks pretty much before you really have any idea what that medication's going to do inside of that brain. But these people are only going to be kept in either institutionalized or in a hospital environment for a week. So you know, you really don't have any idea what that medication's going to do, because the nervous system is on the slow track of recovery. It's not in a hurry, but the insurance company's in a hurry. So if you don't get coverage, if you don't get better during that 6 week block of time, then you're over. You're past the point where they say you now qualify for more rehabilitation. I would rather see rehab go the same amount or more, of course, but for a longer period of time, because the nervous system requires that time for it to realign itself within itself in order to heal.
Next we go to Carol in Wauwatosa. Hi, Carol, you're on the air.
Thank you. A quick question. My friend had a stroke and lost her ability to speak. However, she was able to sing. She was from Spain, and she sang all of her life, I mean, from childhood. And her husband said that, yes, she was able to sing. Mm-hmm. Are they from two different sides of the brain?
They are. Thank you, Carla, for that. It's different circuitry. And, you know, when it comes to the brain, it's cells talking to cells in very specific circuits, and then those circuits have certain functions. And it's quite common that people who cannot speak because they have a left hemisphere problem, they still can sing. And so they can actually make up little songs about what they want to communicate. in order to communicate that way. It's also interesting that a lot of individuals who have left hemisphere damage and they cannot speak, when they get really, really, really mad, they can yell at you.
Actually, I can attest to that, yeah.
Exactly, and it's like, oh my God, where did that come from? And she can do this, or he can do this, so it's really fascinating. And the thing is that we're all wired similarly, but uniquely to ourselves. So, but this is the kind of exploration that I think should be going on. How do we communicate with this person? Where is the exact problem? What circuits can we assume are wiped out? But then there are all these other things that we can do. I had a woman contact me. She has a 5-year-old son, and the 5-year-old son was normal in every way except he would not write with his right hand or his left hand. He could not write. It was as though he could not remember the numbers. But she read my book, and I could type, but I couldn't write. So she put a keyboard in front of him, and he wrote a sentence and signed it with his name.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
Through a typewriter, or through a computer board. So it's really a matter of trying to figure out, okay, what is that brain capable of?
Angela in West Allis is our next caller. Hi, Angela.
Hi there. I just wanted to ask your guest if she ever tries to re-experience that blissful feeling and intentionally turn down our constant brain chatter just to find a little peace.
Thank you, Angela. I do all the time. It was I never lost my right hemisphere, so that bliss is always with me, and I'm so clear from having had this experience that all I have to do is just say, okay, language, you're going away. I'm going to come to the present moment. And by coming to the present moment and focusing on what's right in front of me, the face in front of me, or the nature scene in front of me, letting the edges blur, dropping out the details, purposefully choosing to bring my mind to this present moment, then I go back into just that feeling of peace. So I'm real clear, and that works real easily for me, and I really believe that anybody can train themselves to do that.
Well, you're lucky, because some people spend many years to get to that state practicing.
Well,
you know,
it sounds like
meditation type thing.
It also sounds like yoga, Jill.
It does.
Yeah.
It's meditation, mm-hmm. yoga. There are lots of different tools that people have used over the years to quiet that language center. And for me, I'm just, because I had this trauma, I can just go back and forth without any problem.
Angela, thanks for the call. Joyce in Oconomowoc is with us. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My 12-year-old grandson this year had a severe ski accident and as a result had brain injury. And the reason I'm calling is to talk about the rehab that he is receiving. He was in a coma for 2 weeks, and now he is in rehab. This is in England, actually. And the rehab, I'm just fascinated by some of the things that they're doing. The first week he was there, they went to a farm and planted seeds. He made bread. His injury was on the left side of the brain, and the things they are doing are just amazing. He's not just sitting in a room and squeezing a ball or whatever. They're just doing wonderful things with him. But his attitude also, I'm surprised that his attitude has just remained so positive and so uplifting. I'm very encouraged by it.
Thank
beautiful.
You, Trace.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Any physical movement that they can get him involved in, that's the kinesthetic learning of the body. In the right hemisphere, if his injury was in left, as you said, then movement is strengthening the part of him that is good. And I do believe that that's what we do. The more we can strengthen what is good, then we can build onto that the circuits that need to be communicated with. So I think that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. It took you, about 8 years to fully recover?
It did. It took 8 years before I decided that I was 100% as capable physically, emotionally, spiritually, cognitively as I had been before.
Yeah, and you are 100% back to your old self right now.
Well, I wouldn't say I was back to my old self, because my old self didn't have the insight that
That's
I now
true.
Have. And so I'm kinder to myself. I'm more patient with others. I'm much more compassionate than I had been before. But I am 100% in function again.
Yeah. And now you're not working anymore with the Brain Bank? You're doing something different, did you say?
No, I am. I still travel for the Harvard Brain Bank, and I sing for brains. There's a shortage of brains donated for this kind of research. I'm just no longer in the lab.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank...
But that doesn't mean that I'm not headed back into the lab sometime.
Well, I wish we had time to hear you sing a song for us, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy. It's been great.
Yeah. Jill Bolte Taylor. She is the author of My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey, and recently named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in 2008. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour, and thanks to Michelle Kofel for on-air production. Let me remind you that tomorrow, lots of fun happening in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Public Radio has Ira Flatow in town, host of Talk of the Nation Science Friday. He's going to be broadcasting Science Friday live from Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Public Museum, from 1 until 3 tomorrow afternoon. There's also going to be a reception following that. And there's also going to be a dinner in the early evening. You're invited to be a part of all the festivities. Get more information at WPR.org and join us in Milwaukee tomorrow.